Turn with me, if you would, to Daniel chapter 2. And I'm going to read part of one of my favorite accounts in the Bible. There's a beauty in this account of prophecy, of godliness, a display of the mercy and power of God, and it's in the life of a dedicated man of God. Daniel is a man whose relationship with God is something that I believe each of us craves. It was so deep and so personal that multiple times God is referred to as the God of Daniel, or the king said, your God. How many of us would love to have somebody be able to say, the God of Wayne, the God of Kyle, the God of your name? How many of us would love to have that deep of a relationship with God, that people see that in our lives? That is what they see, is God working. And that's one thing that I love about the book of Daniel and about Daniel and the stories about him. In this story, I believe one of the, or at least in my perception, one of the greatest parts of this story is the prophecy of the coming kingdom, the kingdom of heaven. That would be evidenced by Jesus in his teachings. And that's the title of my devotional this morning, is the kingdom of heaven. I'm going to kind of jump into the story here because the chapter is kind of long. But the context of this is the king had a dream. King Nebuchadnezzar had a dream. He couldn't remember what it was, but it was something that was unsettling to him. He wanted to know what the dream was, and he wanted to know what the dream meant. And his wise men weren't able to do it, and they got frustrated, and he essentially said, you're asking something that's impossible. No one is going to be able to do this. And the king was upset, and he said, you're going to be put to death. Daniel said, asked the guard, when the guard came to arrest him and to kill him, he said, give us a little bit of time. And then he went and prayed with his friends. And we're going to jump in here in verse 24. Therefore Daniel went unto Arioch, whom the king had ordained to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went in and said thus unto him, destroy not the wise men of Babylon. Bring me in before the king, and I will show unto the king the interpretation. Then Arioch brought in Daniel before the king in haste, and said thus unto him, I have found a man of the captives of Judah that will make known unto the king the interpretation. The king answered and said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, art thou able to make known unto me the dream which I have seen and the interpretation thereof? Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, the secret which the king hath demanded, cannot the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, the soothsayers show unto the king? But there is a God in heaven that revealeth secrets and maketh known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days. Thy dream and the visions of thy head upon thy bed are these. As for thee, O king, thy thoughts came into thy mind upon thy bed. What should come to pass hereafter? And he that revealeth secrets maketh known to thee what shall come to pass. But as for me, this secret is not revealed to me for any wisdom that I have more than any living, but for their sakes that shall make known the interpretation to the king, and that thou mightest know the thoughts of thy heart. Thou, O king, sawest, and behold a great image. This great image, whose brightness was excellent, stood before thee, and the form thereof was terrible. This image's head was of fine gold, his breast and arms of silver, his belly and thighs of brass, his legs of iron, his feet part of iron and part of clay. Thou sawest till that a stone was cut without hands, which smote the image upon the feet which were of iron and clay, and brake them to pieces. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together, and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors. And the wind carried them away, that no place was found for them. And the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This is the dream, and we will tell the interpretation thereof before the king. Thou, O king, art a king of kings, for the God of heaven hath given thee a kingdom, power and strength and glory. And wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field and the fowls of the heaven, hath he given unto thine hand, and hath made thee ruler over all of them. Thou art this head of gold. And after thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee, and another third kingdom of brass, which shall bear rule over all the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, For as much as iron breaketh in pieces and subdueth all things, and as iron that breaketh all these, shall it break in pieces and bruise. And whereas thou sawest the feet and toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, but there shall be in it of the strength of iron, for as much as thou sawest the iron mixed with miry clay. And as the toes of the feet were part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken. And whereas thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. And in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. And the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. For as much as thou sawest that the stone was cut out of the mountains without hands, and that it brake in pieces the iron, the brass, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God hath made known to the king what shall come to pass hereafter. And the dream is certain, and the interpretation thereof sure. And that's where I'm going to stop for now. Here was a time of confusion. The king was worried. And I think it's worthwhile to note what Daniel's position was in the government at this point. After this, he was assigned a position as a ruler. He had a high position in the kingdom. But it appears that at this point, he was simply one of many wise men. In fact, he was low enough on the totem pole, he wasn't even given first dibs at interpreting the king's dream. It appears that he found out about it when the guard showed up to arrest him. And so he wasn't yet the eminent ruler that he would become, or the eminent, why can't I think of the word, the assistant to the king or his counselor. And so he had a lot to lose either way. How much pressure do you think Daniel was under to come up with a good interpretation for the king, something that would have felt nice? He could have taken that dream and said, you know, king, this is what you dreamt. And what it means is that you're the head of gold and you rule all these others. All these others are kingdoms down there that are just not as good as you. You're the best and you're always going to be the best. Just like that stone came out of the mountain and broke the image in pieces, that's what you're going to do to all the others. And he could have made the king feel so good about himself. But he didn't. I can only imagine the pressure that was on him with all these other wise men to just come up with a good answer that the king's going to like. And we think of the context of the empire of Babylon at this point. It was not yet quite at its zenith, quite at its apex, but it was well on the way. The Babylonian Empire would go on to conquer parts of Egypt, modern-day Turkey, almost the entirety of the smaller Middle Eastern countries, Iraq, or what is now Iraq. And it was huge. And here was this prisoner, a man who was out of his own country, who was supposed to be telling this king something. The pressure had to be immense. King Nebuchadnezzar was used to prompt obedience, uncompromising obedience. His response to failure was eradication. You can't help me? You're dead. His whims were taken as absolute truth. And is it easy to find ourselves maybe in a similar situation where someone can't help us, or maybe they voice an uncomfortable opinion? We try to kill them. Not physically, of course, but maybe we try to destroy their reputation or their credibility or any influence they might have. It's easy for me to put myself in the place of the king, where my whims must be carried out by everyone else on pain of death. And then the interpretation, Daniel's response to the king, he was tactful, yet he was direct. He admitted to not being able to reveal the dream or understand it on his own. He turned it back to God. And that was a tremendous move of faith. It took the conversation out of the place where it was right then. That was a place of fear people afraid for their lives. It was a place of accusations. Why can't you interpret it? Why can't you interpret it? It was a place of death. He took the conversation to God. He said, "There is a God in heaven that revealeth secrets." And he made it clear that's where his allegiance lay. But he did it in humility. In verse 30, we see how he says, "This isn't shown to me because I'm better than the rest of the wise men." He didn't claim to have any more discernment than all the rest. And he didn't assign blame to them for their difficulty in seeing through this. He didn't say, "You guys are a bunch of imposters because you weren't able to come up with this thing that I came up with." He didn't call them fakers, stupid, unintelligent. Neither did he give himself the title of being clear-headed, visionary, capable, upright. He took it back to God. And he said, "There's a God in heaven that revealeth secrets. It's nothing that I've done that makes me better than anyone else, that he's chosen to reveal it through me." But he said, it's all for God's glory. And in the dream itself, the head of gold is understood to be the Babylonian Empire under King Nebuchadnezzar, which was then overthrown by the Medo-Persian Empire with Darius and Cyrus the Great. Cyrus was met in the field of battle by Alexander the Great, who defeated him. That was the Grecian Empire, followed by the legs of iron, the Romans, whose empire eventually was divided, and that's the mixed with the iron and clay mixed. And then we come to my favorite part, the stone cut without hands. Jesus is called the cornerstone. He's also called a stone of stumbling. What was he to this image? Was he a cornerstone to the image, or was he a stone of stumbling? It broke the image in pieces. And I think there's a tremendous lesson in that for our lives. Maybe the things that we try to build on our own, these mighty kingdoms, the things that we feel are important to be seen. Perhaps for that, Jesus is a stone of stumbling. The Bible also calls him a rock of offense. But for those who are part of the kingdom of God, Jesus is called the chief cornerstone, the best part, the most important part of the foundation. And this kingdom grew. It wasn't standing in one place like this image was. It grew till it covered the whole world, the whole earth. And we are a part of that kingdom, a kingdom that encompasses the whole world, that thrives in spite of heads of gold or other earthly impediments that earthly forces construct. This kingdom lives in our hearts, and it grows as it's lived out in our lives. And Christ made it clear that this kingdom exists outside of earthly circumstances. He told his disciples in John 18, verse 36, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now is my kingdom not from hence." And I think of what we face. What is up with the state of the world right now? Countries that we thought were stable, that we thought were civilized, economically solvent, all of a sudden there's war. People are acting barbaric. Many people are living in abject poverty. People who are just like us. You know, it's easy for us to look at these refugees and assume they always were poor. No, many of them lived middle-class lives. They had jobs, they had cars, they had houses, they had money in the bank. And forces outside of their control took that all away from them. And now they're at the mercy of the goodness of others. And that's unsettling. I don't like to equate myself with that. It's easier for me to think that they were always in that circumstance, and so therefore I don't have to worry about that happening to me. It's unsettling when I put myself on the same footing as people to whom that happens. And that's because we're human and we feel fear. So I encourage us to remember again the context of Daniel's life here. He wasn't a ruler when he brought this to the king. He had been conquered. He was essentially a refugee living in the courts of the king. And here, again, he was at threat of losing his life for something that had nothing to do with him in the first place. It wasn't his fault that the king had a dream he couldn't interpret. How unfair! How unjust! How discouraging! But where did Daniel turn? And did he turn there alone? I think it's beautiful how Daniel brought his friends around him, and together they went to God. And I believe there's a strong indication for our lives. When we find ourselves in those places of turmoil, am I just going to God by myself? Or am I turning to those around me and saying, come, let's seek the Lord together, and the strength that's in that. What about my personal fears? What are things that I fear? What are things that you fear? Are finances a stress? Does it feel like you're misunderstood, alone? Are you afraid to die, knowing that you'll meet God? Does your future feel scary? Does the government scare you? Does the decline of spiritual awareness in the church or in Christianity at large keep you up at night? Are you afraid of being unpopular? The answers for our fears are the same as they were for Daniel. And I think of how many of these questions that I just asked were true of Daniel. How many of those things was he facing himself? Most of them, if not all of them. He and his friends had a lot of reason to worry. But let's do what they did. Let's come together with those who seek after God, study his word, seek his face, fast and pray, and give it to him. Because we can be assured of one thing, and that is God's kingdom is always triumphant. I love stories with happy endings, and maybe that's why I love this account so much. Because Christ is absolutely going to conquer. His kingdom is absolutely going to reign forever and ever. In Revelation 11, verse 15, it says, and the seventh angel sounded, and there were great voices in heaven saying, the kingdoms of this world are become the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever. And it's not tied to earthly kingdoms. No matter what the rulers of the world decide, we serve a king who will always triumph. And we're promised a part of that kingdom. In James 2, verse 5, it says, hearken, my beloved brethren, hath not God chosen the poor of this world, rich in faith, and heirs of the kingdom, which he hath promised to them that love him? And our part is to be like Daniel, rich in faith, poor in spirit, full of humility, not full of myself, seeking God, not advancement, praying, not pestering, going directly to God with those whose desire it is to serve him and know his will, and allowing him to speak into our hearts and spread his kingdom throughout the whole world through us.